The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated November 21/November 28, 2022. As usual, it is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border on the front cover. Time, in large block capital lettering, is in white, superimposed upon a gray-beige background, on which there is an illustration. It has bars, red bars, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 red bars. It has a little square in blue splattered around, and on top of the bars and the blue square are white stars. Let's see, there are 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20 of those. And on top of that is a black squiggle. It's just a squiggle in black atop the red bars, white stars, and blue square, possibly rectangle. I don't have a ruler. That illustration is captioned Democracy. Beginning now with psychology, as the heading, with the title, Americans Just Aren't Feeling Each Other, by Carl Vick. A public opinion poll may seem a lousy place to look for a ray of hope. After all, a Time-Harris survey conducted in the weeks before the midterm elections found that only about a quarter of Americans, 27%, said their feelings about the state of the nation are positive. And yet, asked in the same poll about their own feelings, Americans were measurably less downbeat. For every topic we talked about or asked about, more people judged it to be bumming out the country than said it was bothering them personally. While 63% say the economy is negatively affecting the mood of the country, for instance, only 57% called it a drag on their own outlook. 50% of people said rights issues, including race relations, were adversely affecting the nation's mood, but only 39% said they affected their own. A similar gap showed up when the survey offered a list of emotions, asking people to choose the one they had felt most over the previous 30 days, and later to choose the one that described the mood of Americans overall. Given the near constant stream of doom and gloom Americans absorb from the news, it is unsurprising that they characterize the nation's mood as frustrated, 23%, anxious, 12%, disappointed, 11%, notes Will Johnson, CEO of the Harris Poll. The good news, however, is that the leading adjectives they use to describe their own mood are hopeful, 15%, happy, 14%. Only 14% report that they themselves are frustrated. What is going on? There is reason to believe that, when asked to describe the state of the nation, people naturally describe the one they see on TV or read about on their phones, a place defined by strife, confrontation, and extremes. And that is before being amplified by social media. In other words, America's citizens may not be nearly as distressed as America's political discourse is. A discourse that, of course, includes polls that tell us how distressed we are. To dig deeper, a Boston-area think tank called Populous has endeavored to measure private opinion, or views that a person holds but might not share with a pollster. Told of the persistent mood perception gap in the Time-Harris survey, Populous founder Todd Rose said, "I would predict the gap is actually substantially larger." The heart of the issue, Rose theorizes, is that people likely sense that certain responses are expected based on how they have identified themselves. Most people want to be with their group, not against their group, he says. So whenever you're reading the mood of the group, people will kind of go toward what they are supposed to feel or say. To get beyond those expectations, Populous will slide a sensitive statement in with four other statements that are both less delicate and also previously polled, then ask the subject to select three statements they agree with. After sorting the results, Populous was able to learn this past spring that while 43% of people had told a pollster that public schools focus too much on racism, only 33% said that when asked less directly. Similar gaps showed up on abortion and the effectiveness of masks against spreading COVID-19. In other research, Populous has found Americans largely agree on which issues are most important to them, but assume incorrectly that other people feel different. The persistence of that perception, Rose notes, is the same as being truly divided. But if we are actually not, that's more than a ray of hope. It's a shaft of sunlight. Here is the risk report by Ian Bremmer. Pakistan's poisonous politics. Pakistan's politics were plenty toxic even before the failed assassination against ousted former Prime Minister Imran Khan. When Khan was removed from power following a parliamentary vote of no confidence in April, he claimed Pakistan's military and its friends in Washington wanted to silence him. He then kicked off a series of protest marches that have drawn massive crowds. In October, Khan insinuated that the army had killed a journalist, an uncharacteristically blunt frontal assault on Pakistan's army, and the country's head of military intelligence felt compelled to call an unprecedented public press conference to deny the charge. Officials in the current government, led by Shehbaz Sharif, accused Khan of terrorism, illegally receiving money from foreigners, and other forms of financial fraud. Then, during a protest rally earlier this month, Khan was shot in the leg. Some of his supporters were wounded, and one was killed. It is all part of a three-way fight between Pakistan's current government, its powerful and politically meddlesome military, and Khan, a former cricket star and playboy who governed as a Muslim fundamentalist. Khan blamed the attempt to kill him on Prime Minister Sharif, the interior minister and a senior military officer. If some Pakistanis who doubted past charges of conspiracy find them more plausible now that the shots have been fired, critics within the government have accused Khan of staging the shooting to discredit Sharif and win sympathy. The suspected gunman provided conflicting accounts of his own motives before finally settling on blasphemy as Khan's unpardonable offense. Khan himself claims there was more than one shooter. The government and military are dragging their feet on launching a formal investigation. Even with one, the mysteries surrounding this event are unlikely ever to be solved, and each side will believe the version of events it chooses to credit. The political temperature continues to rise. Since October 28, the still popular Khan has led what he's billed as another long march across the country toward Islamabad, the capital, to protest his ouster as prime minister and to demand early elections, which he says would restore him to power with a large popular mandate to clean up corruption and uproot a deep state-style conspiracy to keep power in a very few hands. He is popular enough that his rivals and enemies have no intention of giving him that opportunity. The government is not required to hold elections until October 2023. Khan's challenges and this latest political intrigue will only make it harder for Sharif's government to manage an economy in deep trouble. Decades of waste and corruption have taken a cumulative toll, and Khan's populist economic policies as prime minister only added to the IOUs of a country that was already billions in debt, particularly to China. Recent floods that killed almost 1,500 people and impacted millions of lives have inflicted tens of billions of dollars in damage. Inflation has reached historic heights. Current Prime Minister Sharif has worked hard to win a $7 billion relief package from the International Monetary Fund, which would require Pakistan to, among other things, cut state subsidies to help Pakistanis pay their soaring energy bills. An austerity budget and more spending cuts are badly needed to bring Pakistan's books a bit closer to balance. But Khan, seeing an unmissable opportunity to attack the government, has denounced the cuts. He claims implausibly that if he becomes prime minister again, the cuts won't be needed. A confrontation is coming. Once his leg has sufficiently healed, Khan will rejoin thousands of his supporters and continue their march toward Islamabad. Men holding guns will be waiting, and no one is likely to back down. There's a colorful photo here. The caption reads, "Supporters of former Prime Minister Khan's party protest on November 4 in Karachi to condemn the shooting of their leader." This crowd includes men, women, and children. Green on the top, red on the bottom, with inscriptions which I'm unable to read, are being held high. It looks like all ages and genders, and one person is holding a portrait of an individual with fairly short hair and wearing a black tunic. It doesn't say if it's Khan or not, and I don't know. But it's a very colorful photo, and it's a crowd. People are massed together in this party protest in Karachi. The coronavirus brief by Jamie Ducharme, health correspondent. And there's a photo here in color, except it's dark. Subway riders, some masked, wait on a train platform in New York City. Men and women here dressed casually, most of them looking at handheld electronic devices, but they're standing on a platform that looks like concrete with a wide striping of yellow dividing them on the platform with the darker tracks below. Though it may feel as if COVID-19 is a thing of the past, researchers fear another surge is coming just in time for the holiday season. Here are the precautions experts say you should be taking this year. Get your Omicron booster now instead of timing it for just before holiday events, says Dr. Kristen Moffitt, an infectious disease physician at Boston Children's Hospital. It takes a couple of weeks after vaccination for your body to mount an immune response, and that protection should stay strong for at least 2 months. If people get boosted now, their maximum immunity from that booster would get them through the end of 2022, Moffitt says. Take a rapid test before you gather to avoid unknowingly spreading the virus to your loved ones, suggests Dr. Roy Gulick, chief of infectious disease at Weill Cornell Medicine and New York Presbyterian. At-home tests should pick up newer variants like BQ.1. But if you test negative and have classic symptoms like sore throat, body aches, and fever, you should still stay home. Stay safe during travel. Masks are not required for most travel anymore, but Gulick recommends wearing one, at least for certain portions of your trip. In general, air quality is better on planes than on trains and buses, but Gulick recommends masking in the airport and when your plane is taxiing, since filtration systems may not be turned on when the plane is grounded. And if you're traveling by bus or train, it's a good idea to mask during your entire journey. Don't forget about other viruses. In addition to COVID-19, influenza and RSV are sickening lots of people right now. Moffitt says that's an extra reason to take precautions like masking during travel and avoiding high-risk settings, such as crowded indoor events before your holiday plans, particularly if you will be seeing anyone immunocompromised or otherwise vulnerable. This is the milestones page. First of all, died Aaron Carter, who rose to fame as a child pop singer at 34, November 5. Julie Powell, whose book Julie and Julia reignited interest in Julia Child, October 26. One, WON, a majority in the Israeli Knesset in a November 1 vote by a far-right coalition, setting up Benjamin Netanyahu's return to power. Suspended, NBA star Kyrie Irving by the Brooklyn Nets, November 3, after he promoted an anti-Semitic film on Twitter. Apologized, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol, November 7, for a crowd surge that killed 156 in Seoul, October 29. Crashed a plane into Lake Victoria in Tanzania, November 6. Precision Air said 19 people died and 24 were rescued. Divorced NFL star Tom Brady and supermodel Gisele Bündchen, after 13 years of marriage, the pair announced October 28. And another died, Jerry Lee Lewis, demon saint of rock and roll, by Richard Corliss. There's a black and white photo here of Jerry Lee Lewis sitting at a grand piano with microphones near his face, and he's in profile here. His face is in profile, so perhaps he's singing to a crowd in the audience off his right shoulder. Like a ringmaster letting a lion out of its cage to terrify and thrill the kids at the circus, Steve Allen unleashed the 21-year-old Jerry Lee Lewis to a primetime TV audience on his variety show, July 28, 1957. As Lewis ripped into his debut hit, Whole Lot of Shakin' Goin' On, the same startled excitement seized the folks at home as when Elvis Presley made his first national TV appearance 18 months earlier. The moment was that epochal. Lewis, who died October 28 at age 87, had a far briefer purchase on stardom than Elvis, not least because the rockabilly icon made as much trouble as he did music. The Killer, as he was known, was a charter member of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, known for two songs. Great Balls of Fire was the other. He defined a new genre by revealing its tangled roots in white and black gospel stylings, in the boogie-woogie, tickling, and pounding of a barrelhouse piano. Lewis unleashed the saints and demons of rock and roll. He was rock's pioneer, pianist, singer, preacher, sinner, the great blonde thug of music that might have been God's or the devil's. From the beginning, Jerry Lee was addicted to music, inhaling all kinds, then reproducing and blending it on the family piano. When he was 20, Lewis made the rounds of Nashville record companies, but the belligerent weirdness showed through. The Grand Ole Opry turned him down then and 4 years thereafter, but Sam Phillips, Elvis's mentor at Sun Records, signed Lewis to play piano for a Carl Perkins session, December 4, 1956. That's when Elvis and Johnny Cash dropped by. The four sang a bunch of gospel numbers and pop songs. Soon Lewis was selling records by the tons. But his star fell. First, he acknowledged that he married Myra Gale Brown, the 13-year-old daughter of his cousin, in 1957. More trouble followed. In 1976, he shot his bass player, Butch Owens, in the chest. Accidentally, it is said, Owens survived. Lewis's fourth wife, Jaron Pate, died in a swimming pool in 1982. His fifth wife, Shawn Stevens, died a few months into their marriage. It was ruled a methadone overdose, but that does not explain the bruised, bloody state of her corpse found by police in the bedroom of their mansion. Through it all, Lewis continued to play a brutal regimen of one-night stands, figuring he could keep on playing till Judgment Day, embodying so much of what was feral and profound about rock and roll. As he announced at the conclusion of his belated, defiant debut at the Grand Ole Opry in 1973, "Let me tell you something about Jerry Lee Lewis, ladies and gentlemen. I am a rockin' rollin', country and western, rhythm and blues, singin' mother F space C-K-E-R." Satan could not have said it better. The person who wrote this article, Richard Corliss, was Time's film critic. He pre-wrote this obituary before his death in 2015. Her Tribe Fed the Pilgrims, she's building on that history, by Olivia B. Waxman, Charlestown, Rhode Island. This is under the heading Nation. When I first call Sherry Pocknett, that's P-O-C-K-N-E-T-T, she's on her way out the door, headed to forage for mushrooms. But the Mashpee Wampanoag chief, chef, and longtime caterer invites me up to her restaurant, Sly Fox Den 2, in Charlestown, Rhode Island, which specializes in East Coast indigenous cuisine. There, in a little red house right by Narragansett Indian tribal lands, she cooks lunch, crisping duck skin like a potato chip, and explains the sunflower oil she's using to prepare our meal can also be rubbed on your hair and skin to keep you looking youthful. Pocknett, 62, is a member of the tribe best known for feeding the pilgrims. Her restaurant, named for her fisherman father and Native American rights advocate chief, Sly Fox, is her own way of using her people's knowledge to feed Americans today. And she hopes the menu shows the breadth and depth of indigenous foods, which are so much more than Thanksgiving turkey. In fact, at Sly Fox Den 2, which opened in June 2021, the only turkey parts are feathers sticking out of a hand-woven basket hanging on the wall. Pocknett explains that her people do eat turkey, but they also respect the birds for their smarts and wear the feathers in their hair in order to observe turkeys' intelligence. Her menu is based on a simple concept. The food I grew up with, she says. She cooks what's local and what's in season. This time of year, that means foods like rabbit and quahogs, hard-shell clams native to the Atlantic coast. A photographer and I watch Pocknet prepare duck hash and venison from a deer freshly killed by her son-in-law, which she skinned herself, topped with onion rings. The battered onion rings, she admits, are not exactly a deep-rooted tradition. They're from a mix, she says, but I just love them. She also makes journey cakes, cornmeal patties with dried cranberries, versions of which have a long history as a road trip food. As she stews a reduction of beech plums harvested by her niece on Martha's Vineyard to pair with the venison, Pocknet explains many people do not realize this tart native fruit is both edible and delicious, so they go unpicked, left to the birds. To wash it all down, there are pinch pots full of iced tea made from boiled sassafras roots, which were plucked right behind the restaurant. Even if you've never heard of this common North American tree, you probably know the flavor. It was long the key ingredient of root beer. The feast is riffing on foods that appeared at the meal known as the First Thanksgiving in 1621. According to historian David Silverman's This Land Is Their Land, waterfowl, venison, cornmeal, and seafood would have featured prominently at the colonists' table. Stopping here now for the caption of four photographs in color, but interestingly, they're all fairly dull in color. Lots of browns, off-white, deep blue, and more browns and gray. From left, Pocknet in her restaurant, and she is wearing the white chef's coat, not chief's coat, chef's coat. She has a graying hair, which appears to be held on the top of her head in a bun formation. She's looking askance from the camera, possibly out the window, because she's seated at a table with a ketchup container and windows to her right. She's wearing long, amber-looking drop earrings. They might be a stone or they might be pottery. Then the next photo is duck hash. Oh dear. I wouldn't be able to tell you it was duck hash. It's brown with a blob of white, maybe cream or a sauce, and a little bit of green, pale green, chives perhaps or some other herb. It's being served in a white bowl with a gold rim. It's very attractive looking. And then the next photo is she is displaying sage. Again, we see only the white chef's jacket with two hands in the front. And on the hands, it looks like an actual little plant. It's in the lovely muted gray-green of sage. And then the last photo, we see the back of her. She's wearing long, dark slacks, flats, shoes that are flats, her white chef's jacket. Now here, the back of her head looks more black than gray, and she's carrying a shovel in her right hand. She's walking down a concrete pathway, hence the gray, and it's leading into a forest that the trees of which are nearly defoliated, but there are a couple in the foreground still showing some fall colors. She's foraging there at her daughter's farm. Returning to the text, restaurants specializing in Native American cuisine are rare, but a devoted core of indigenous chefs are working to raise their profile. Owamni, an upscale eatery in Minneapolis focused on indigenous cuisine and ingredients, won the James Beard Award for Best New Restaurant this year. Owner Sean Sherman, an Oglala Lakota chef, says Native American restaurateurs face the same challenges that other people of color face in the industry. We've lost a lot of our own resources, especially when it comes to land ownership. Sherman says, and a lot of us coming out of the reservations are coming from poor communities. Despite the fraught history, many Wampanoag tribe members still enjoy gathering with their families on Thanksgiving Day. It is a day off, after all. Chinooka Pocket, Sherry's nephew, who helps run an oyster and quahog farm in the Cape Cod area, plans to serve his family wild salmon that he caught in Washington State with nets he made himself. At his Thanksgiving table, there's always an extra plate with a little serving of everything for the ancestors and spirits. Danielle Greendeer, who runs a store that sells traditional art and jewelry in the heart of the Mashpee tribal land, harvested corn for the meal she is hosting at her home. She sees the occasion as a natural way to mark the first Thanksgiving, turning the holiday into a celebration of survival. After all, she says, the only way we can survive is by eating. While customers at Pocknet's restaurant wait for their food to come out, they can page through a book called If You Lived During the Plymouth Thanksgiving. Plymouth is spelled P-L-I-M-O-T-H, which retells the American myth from the perspective of the Wampanoag people. And yet, year-round, many customers still just want her to tell them about Thanksgiving. So she tells them the story she heard growing up. We are a loving, giving people. We helped them, and then look what happened. Emphasizing the statement with outstretched arms. They took everything from us and killed us. We got wiped out. But not all the way. We are still here. We have been here for over 12,000 years. We ain't going nowhere. Here is the brief health, 5 ways to become a morning person by Angela Haupt. Are you a lark, someone who greets the day before 7 a.m., or a night owl who thrives after dark? Some 30% to 40% of the answer depends on your genes, says Philip Gehrman, director of the Sleep, Neurobiology, and Psychopathology Lab at the University of Pennsylvania. But your internal clock is mostly determined by other factors, like your age, sex, environment, and distance from the snooze button. Few people are extreme larks or night owls, and most of us fall somewhere in between, says Jennifer Martin, president of the board of directors for the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. So if you want or need to start waking up at the crack of dawn, that is an achievable goal. There are lots of good health reasons to rise earlier. Research has linked the early bird life to better mental health and a lower likelihood of conditions such as depression and schizophrenia. Other research has found that morning people tend to be more proactive than late risers. Plus, waking up early is often the only chance for some people, like parents, to claim time and space for themselves. If you are determined to rise with the sun, or simply catch more of the morning, know that transitioning to a new schedule requires time and effort. Sleep experts suggest these strategies. 1. Seek out as much natural light as possible. Bright light exposure is critical in the morning, or the AM, because light suppresses melatonin, a hormone that induces sleepiness. The sun is the driver of our internal clock, Martin says. When you wake up, pop outside for a brisk walk around the block, or sit out back while you sip a cup of coffee. Martin also advises against blackout curtains, which stop the morning light from having this wake-up effect. If the brightness bothers you overnight, consider wearing an eye mask that you take off as you start to wake up. 2. Ease in gradually. You can approach your journey to early rising in 2 days, Martin says. One is by plunging straight into an early wake-up time, knowing that you will feel tired during the transition, but will naturally start falling asleep earlier within a few weeks. But for some people, like those who need to drive long distances, those first few days of exhaustion are not safe. In those cases, Martin recommends gradually easing in. What I will suggest to people is to shift half an hour, wait a few days, shift another half an hour, wait a few days, and then shift another half an hour, she says. That's a little easier for people to tolerate. 3. Be consistent, even on weekends. Becoming a morning person is a 7-day-a-week job. Decide what time you are going to wake up every day and stick to it without exception. 4. If someone says, I want to be more of a morning person during the week, but I want to sleep in on weekends, that is not going to work, says Gehrman. Wind down in the evenings to get at least 7 hours of sleep a night. Inch your bedtime earlier as you transition to a new schedule. Starting at least an hour before you hit the sack, cut back on how much exposure to bright light you are getting, Gehrman advises. Research indicates artificial light exposure in the late evening suppresses your body's ability to generate melatonin, which could interfere with your ability to fall asleep and your sleep quality. If you want to ensure you fall asleep quickly, Brittany Blair of the Stanford Center for Sleep Sciences and Medicine suggests trying small amounts of melatonin. A 300 mcg, that's probably microgram dose, 3 to 4 hours before you plan to go to bed, will help you start to feel sleepy, she says. 5. Plan something to look forward to. To entice you out of bed, Martin suggests treating yourself to something special you can enjoy first thing. Now is the time to go buy your favorite coffee, or pick up some pastries to have when your alarm goes off at 5 a.m., she says. You are not dreading it if you think of that. She also recommends booking 6 a.m. fitness classes. Doing so helps hold you accountable and provides an extra reason not to hit the snooze button again and again. If that does not appeal, use the time to connect with friends in other time zones who may be commuting to work just as you are waking up. Judith Berman is writing a couple of reviews that I will read next. A Missed Calling. There's a very small inset photo here of a man, a young man, dark hair, gray shirt, black tie. It appears he's holding something, perhaps a piece of artwork that he's looking at. A Missed Calling is a new show from David E. Kelley, veteran creator behind Big Little Lies and Ally McBeal. Used to be an event worth anticipating, but lately the demand for Kelley's brand of smart yet soapy dramas has exploded. Presumably stretched thin, he seems to have a disappointing new thriller or procedural out on a different platform every month. The Undoing, Nine Perfect Strangers, Anatomy of a Scandal, The Lincoln Lawyer, and so on. The Calling, an adaptation of Dror Mishani's books about a Jewish detective with the unlikely name Avraham Avraham, is his offering to Peacock. Directed by Barry Levinson, the series casts Jeff Wilbush, unorthodox, as the brilliant, intense, ascetic, deeply spiritual NYPD lone wolf who's looking into a teen boy's disappearance. The case gets complicated, as they always do. Avi's manipulative methods start to upset his colleagues, a standard occupational hazard for genius TV cops. Framed as a maverick, he is really just a stock anti-hero with a Talmudic twist. If you have watched enough Kelley to know his men are ogres and his women victims and enablers, the plot will feel familiar. Scripts lean on pop psychology and cliché. I don't know my husband anymore. The show is not incompetent. It held my attention for the most part. It is just a shame to watch Kelley keep churning out mediocrities. The Calling debuted November 10 on Peacock. Another review by Berman. Violence and tenderness converge in the Wild West. There's a larger photo here. It's at night, and it's outside a tent. And it's a woman, a young woman with longish dark hair, looking into the distance, wearing a bright scarlet gown, long sleeves, high neck, the blousy-looking puffed sleeves, and she's wearing a brooch, it was kind of a Celtic knot brooch, a large brooch, gold finished on her right chest area. For the Europeans who colonized it in the 19th century, the American West promised money and freedom. Civilization was an afterthought, except within the indigenous communities they massacred and displaced. The conflict between ruthless, lawless self-interest and the human instinct to form bonds of mutual care has always been central to the Western genre. Yet it is rare to see a variation on the theme achieve the depth and poignance of The English. The insightful 6-episode Amazon BBC miniseries opens with a chance encounter. Upon arriving at a dusty hotel in the desolate Kansas of 1890, Lady Cornelia Locke, Emily Blunt, finds Eli Whip, with two P's, Chaskey Spencer, beaten and chained outside. She's an English aristocrat on a mission to kill the man who killed her son. He's a newly retired Pawnee scout traveling north to claim land he's owed. She saves him, and then he saves her. Unlike so many other strangers who cross paths on these eerily empty plains, they immediately earn each other's trust. As they ride, it becomes apparent they share more than a direction. Known for the complexity of both his plots and the moral quagmires he creates, writer and director Hugo Blick populates their path with ghoulish characters who harbor all sorts of wild, self-serving beliefs about loyalty, revenge, identity. The English suggests these mismatched convictions converged in an impossible fantasy called the United States of America. TV's greatest Western, Deadwood, arrived at a similar conclusion, citing the adage that history is a lie agreed upon. The story of Cornelia and Eli is a different kind of fiction, and one whose occasional sentimentality only slightly undermines its elegance as a counter-narrative. Violent, macabre, and in many ways tragic, the English does not deny what really happened when cultures collided on the frontier. Instead, it finds beauty in imagining how more humane people in the same situation, united by trust, might have begun to build something better. The English came to Amazon November 11. The funny thing about aging, this is an essay under the heading Time Off Books, and the essay is by Lauren Graham. Years ago, I was in Amsterdam with one of my friends, Jen, when I tripped and fell for absolutely no reason. I lay on the ground for a moment in shock. I was not hurt or anything. I was just surprised. My shoes were tied, the pavement was smooth, and I had not been wildly weaving or jumping around. And yes, I was a little high, Amsterdam, but not in a way that would have led to forgetting how to walk. I looked up from the ground and said, "Jen, gah! What if someday I become one of those people who just falls for no reason?" We found this idea so outrageous that we laughed and laughed, because to me, lying there, barely into my 30s, falling for no reason, was something that happened only to old people. Fast forward to one day, soon after I turned 50, and I again fell for no reason. I slipped on the stairs and tried to save the iPad I was holding. The iPad survived, but my foot was broken. Later that year on a ski trip, I fell again and broke my wrist. I wish I could tell you I was skiing when it happened, but I was merely walking to lunch. The broken wrist was a more serious injury, and I still have a Frankensteinian amount of metal in there holding it all together. I am not sure when exactly it is that you do not feel as young as you used to, but spending a day purchasing specialty items from a hospital supply store might be one indication. I'd never been to such a place before, but in just 1 year I went several times. Suddenly, my freezer was full of gel packs that could be inserted into slings and Velcro foot wraps, and I was forever driving to Beverly Hills to get parts of myself x-rayed. As a result of these injuries, not to mention turning 50, I started to think a lot more about what it means to get older. It occurred to me that I had attended a Legends 60th birthday party. 60 had once seemed impossibly far away, but I was now closer to that number than I felt. And no amount of spa treatments or fasts could do anything about that. When I talk about aging, I am not talking about the terrible, horrible stuff, the serious diseases or conditions. I'm talking about things that are mainly just annoying, but also mystifying in that they show up without warning. I am talking about the moment you realize you've turned 2 p.m. Sunday matinee years old because going to Times Square at 8 p.m. seems like a ridiculous thing to do. And suddenly your entire lunch conversations revolve around the best cream for sore joints. On the one hand, this development is okay because you have people with whom to discuss these things over steamed vegetables and mashed potatoes because spicy foods just do not agree with you anymore. On the other hand, this change sneaks up on you, and like any sneak, it gives you a bit of a scare. Of course I'd thought about aging before. I work in an industry obsessed with how people look. But the concept that this getting older thing was a train that had moved in only one direction had somehow not fully struck me until the year of broken bones. That same year in therapy, I compared my feelings of being panicked to Joan Cusack racing to get the videotape to the newsroom in broadcast news, and the therapist looked at me blankly. That my film references were not those of my slightly younger therapist, and that professionals to whom I entrusted my care were now younger than I, was another change I did not see coming. You spend years looking up to people older than you and figuring they know things you will someday know too. Then one day you're seeking advice from a doctor who hopefully knows more than you do, except for not having seen broadcast news, and life's questions become more complicated. Can you really trust someone with your mental health who does not have even every Jim Brooks movie memorized? Maybe you knew more than you thought you did when you thought older people knew more. During the year of broken bones, I reread all of Nora Ephron's essays. One bothered me in a way it had not before. I feel bad about my neck is a brief, funny essay in the book of the same title. It's also in a collection called The Most of Nora Ephron, which is one of my treasured bedside table books. In this piece, she notices herself and her friends trying every type of shirt collar and turtleneck sweater to hide their aging necks, and concludes in her sharp way that it's a shared fate, part of life, and there's nothing really to be done about it. I cannot possibly say anything about aging or anything else better than Ephron said it. And I'm not going to try. It just bothers me that this incredible woman had anything to worry about regarding her neck. She was not going to be filmed and picked apart over it because she was not an actor and Twitter had not been invented yet. But still, she worried enough to turn it into comedy. When my mother's cancer came back a second time, years after she had been in remission, this is how she told me, "Well, at least I won't have to get a facelift." This was her gallows humor, but also a thought I knew she'd really had. Death versus maintaining youthful beauty should not be a competition. Sometimes a person will tell me that I look exactly the same as I did years before, and I always think, no, I don't. And if I did, it would not be due to natural practices. And what kind of pressure is that? In Efron's essay, she acknowledges that she could have work done on her neck, but that would mean having to get a facelift, which she would never do. So she resigns herself to living with it and moves on. Today the line is blurrier. You can still draw a line at facelifts, but there are all sorts of lasers that supposedly tighten your skin, machines that supposedly shrink fat cells, injections that supposedly re-stimulate collagen production. And there are threads, which are barbed wire-shaped lengths of some other substance designed to be shot into your face at various points to lift it up. But it will sag again eventually as the substance is absorbed, like a slowly dissolving clothesline. You might think we in Hollywood all know who's doing what and can therefore decide what works, but we don't. The people who know are the makeup artists, and none of the good ones name names. They might tell you what's trending, but they will not say who is doing it. They might call their A-listers everyone, as in everyone is loving the threads. Everyone thinks cool sculpting doesn't work. I wish everyone would just publish their activities to be studied in a medical journal for aging actors. That way we could all distinguish between what is real and what is fake, what are the results of genetic blessings, and what are the results of pricey doctors' visits, and then decide for ourselves. The me that looked my best was a me that smoked, was underfed, ran high with anxiety, did not get enough sleep, and still never felt good enough. And gradually, whatever that machine was and whatever adrenaline was fueling it began to break down, and I just could not do it anymore. It was around that time that I began to wonder, at what point is it okay to stop trying to look exactly the same? Maybe there is a reason there are not as many men writing about aging, and the reason isn't that they are not thinking about it. Maybe, like my mother did, like Efron did, turning fears about aging and mortality into contemplation and comedy is just one of those things women are better at. And perhaps this is not a burden, but should be a point of pride. We get to bond with one another with a more constructive, even joyous response to fears about middle life and its injustices than, say, buying a flashy sports car, unless that gives you joy. Maybe the through line here is, let's all give up, a resigned but cheery call to inaction. All the resty lane in the world won't make 80 the new 30, but why not laugh about it? Graham Lauren Graham is the author of Have I Told You This Already?, from which this essay is adapted. How to help green innovation. This year, the annual list of best inventions includes more innovations in sustainability than ever before. Among them is SCC55, a material that significantly enhances silicon lithium battery performance. It is made by Group 14, whose CEO, Rick Luby, spoke about boosting green ingenuity with Baran Singh, CTO of Time CO2, a new platform to help businesses get to net zero. And you can learn more about that on time.com. This is a question and answer format. Singh, Group 14 is slated to make batteries for Porsche EVs, and you just got a $100 million grant from the Department of Energy, but many products don't get that far. What do we need to do to support the green innovation ecosystem? Luby, the struggle is getting from idea to commercialization. There are two chasms. One, you need to have data to get first seed investments, and you need funding to get the data. The second chasm is getting to commercial scale. The problem with venture capital and these ideas is they are not a fast return. So one option is funding incubators, where companies have very, very low-cost access to the best equipment and labs. The Department of Energy's national labs could have this capability, but they are so expensive to work with. If there is a way to subsidize a national labs program, that could give true small businesses, less than 30 people, access to cutting-edge technologies to get their ideas proven to the point where they can get funded. Question. You have created denser, faster-charging EV batteries and are aiming to electrify aviation. How far off is that? Answer. You cannot electrify a 747, at least not in my understanding of physics. But for regional flight, you can charge it in the time it takes to get 20 passengers off and 20 passengers on. Now it makes sense. Now you can fly all day long. You can capitalize quickly. Your fuel expenses go down significantly, and you have got a clean CO2 footprint. That technology is close. I think hyper-regional electric flight is coming. The concept of the air Uber you can take to work to avoid traffic or to the beach. It is going to be transformational. Here's a very short item. Extreme heat. Thousands of migrant workers died in Qatar's construction boom over the past decade, sullying the image of the kingdom hosting the World Cup. Too Hot to Work is a short documentary about how climate change is making outdoor work more dangerous, and it's showing at time.com/Qatar, QATAR-DOC. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.